From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At the United Nations this morning, President Trump ridiculed reports that he ordered his staff to freeze military aid to Ukraine a few days before a phone call in which he pressured the Ukrainian president to investigate political rival Joe Biden. Democrats, meanwhile, will meet in a matter of hours to discuss whether impeachment should be on the table. Joining us now is Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from Virginia, one of seven Democrats from swing districts who wrote in today's Washington Post that they back impeachment if the accusations against the president are true. Congresswoman, what made you decide to do this, or what is different about this than everything that led into the Mueller investigation?
So I think the distinction is very clear, at least it is to me, which is what led me to want to come forward with my opinion and my assessment of these allegations. And primarily, what is different is this. These allegations set forward that a sitting U.S. president allegedly sought to use his position, his power, and security aid dollars to compel or pressure a foreign country to provide information about a political opponent. This is looking forward towards the 2020 elections. This is the potential major abuse of the power of the presidency. This is the potential misuse of foreign security assistance dollars. And for me, it is notably different. And it's finite. It is very specific, the allegations that are being leveraged against the president. And so I thought it was very, very important to enter the conversation. I am pleased that my colleagues joined me in this, to say that from a national security perspective, from the perspective not of politics, not of our particular districts, but from the perspective of those who have served this country, who have sworn an oath, we see this as a departure from everything else that we've been dealing with. We need to treat it as such, and we need to move forward swiftly to get to the bottom of these allegations to either prove or disprove them.
Do you think it's likely that this is going to lead to an impeachment inquiry?
I think it's likely that we will go whatever route allows us to get to the bottom of the circumstance. If that is an impeachment inquiry, if that is inherent contempt powers of Congress, if that is going to court, if that is issuing additional subpoenas, if that is having every person possible related to this issue come before Congress, my position is that Congress should use every tool in its toolbox.
One of the concerns of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, about going as far as impeachment is that it could cost people like you your seats next year. You were in a swing district. Are you worried about that?
I'm worried about my constitutional obligation. I'm worried about the future of our democracy. The allegations against this president are so severe and so troubling that in the grand scheme of things, the only thing that matters is that the American people believe that their votes count. The American people have trust in the system. You know, people in swing districts have all sorts of challenges presented to us. This is no different, but I have to step forward and be a voice related to this issue because it is so profoundly important.
President Trump, as you know, said he did nothing wrong in the phone call, that it was totally appropriate, and that the whistleblower was partisan. How do you respond to that?
I find this to be this excuse to be yet a kind of another example of a trend where we have a president who is willing to degrade the portions of our government, be they law enforcement agencies, be they intel agencies, now Inspector General. The intelligence community Inspector General came forward and said that these allegations are credible and urgent, and by law they should be relayed to Congress. So the bigger concern at this point is the fact that we see the White House and the administration blocking those allegations from coming before Congress as is legally required. And so, you know, I think that overall the allegations against the president are so profound and so disturbing that, you know, it would be unsurprising to me that there would be attempts to distract from them. But again, I go back to the point. We need to either prove them or disprove them.
Have you heard everything you want to hear from Joe Biden about this? This obviously involves his son Hunter's five-year term on the board of a Ukrainian gas company while Biden was vice president. And the Trump administration argues that Biden used his influence to get rid of a prosecutor to protect his son from investigation, although there has been no evidence of wrongdoing so far by Hunter Biden.
Yeah, I think the key is what you just said, which is there's no evidence of wrongdoing. In addition to being a former CIA officer, before that I was a federal agent, I am absolutely always in support of getting to the bottom of the facts and investigating anything that may be concerning. But here there appears to be no evidence of wrongdoing. But more importantly, and the real focal point from a congressional standpoint, would be the allegations against the President of the United States that he misused dollars appropriated by Congress for a security assistance program, sought to leverage them to his own benefit. That's the crux of my concern. That's the crux of my focus. If other entities, law enforcement, want to take up any other investigations related to this larger discussion, I certainly think that is appropriate, or their prerogative, or their mission. But from a congressional standpoint, our focus is protecting the Constitution from potential abuse, allegedly here by the president.
That is Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia, who has signed on along with six other Democrats from swing districts to a letter in today's Washington Post. We'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. Congresswoman, thank you.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Let's bring in Julian Zelizer now, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, for a look through the prism of recent and past history. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So President Trump calling for Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden for, as vice president, pushing to get the Ukrainian prosecutor charged with investigating the oligarch who owned the company his son served on the board of fired. It's like a board game. But what Trump doesn't say, world leaders agreed the prosecutor was corrupt. The theory he was helping his son, as Jeremy said, was thoroughly debunked many times. Start there. We're going to talk later about maybe a similar moment, but is there any other moment like this?
No, this is a pretty unique moment, and I think that's why it's having these kinds of effects in Congress. There are moments when there's accusations of politicians swaying foreign policy. In 1968, there was an accusation that the Nixon campaign influenced negotiations with Vietnam, and it turned out to be true, to try to help their campaign. In 1998, I remember, President Clinton is bombing Iraq during the impeachment crisis, and there's allegations that he was trying to distract the public. But this is about a very specific act, about withholding funds from a government in order to get dirt on an opponent going into a presidential election. It's a kind of abuse that if we still have lines in American politics, he would have crossed them.
Well, and the president's saying today that he did not withhold the funds, that in fact he wanted other countries to pay for the military aid to Ukraine. But then you still have the piece of asking a foreign country for an investigation into a political rival. And the president never mentions his own former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is in jail in part for not paying taxes on the lobbying he did for the former Russian-backed president of Ukraine, or that Manafort at the Republican convention tried to get planks favorable to his former client and Russia into the party platform. Trump's son arranged a meeting with Russians. You'd think he'd stay away from this part of the world, given all of that. But you have another thought on the president's deflection. Yeah.
If there's a strategy, I think it's more than deflection, meaning as this scandal comes up, as this challenge comes up, I do think he's happy to keep saying Ukraine and Joe Biden and corruption over and over again. And I think his assumption is that a lot of the public doesn't follow the details. And this is a way to muddy the waters. It's a way to dirty the character of one of the top Democratic candidates so that a few months from now, if assuming he's still in office, President Trump, he will have characterized Biden in the same way he characterized Hillary Clinton as someone who does illicit things. So I think when you see these interviews and responses, you'll hear him say Biden and Ukraine as many times as possible.
Well, we remember, and The Guardian reminds us, that Trump accused Hillary Clinton of being a birther, an accomplice to sexual assault, a secret ally to Russia. So this was, as we now know, there were these accusations that could be leveled against him. You seem to be saying that he holds up a mirror. It's almost, well, you said to us he uses his own weakness. He's calling Ukraine to ask for interference to launch an attack against someone else, accusing them of it.
No, absolutely. The one thing, there's two things he does pretty effectively. One is he can see the weaknesses and vulnerability in any person or institution almost by instinct. And the second thing we've seen again and again is how he takes these moments when he's the one with the problem and turns that problem on its head and levels it against the person who's attacking them. It's not necessarily going to work. He's certainly not in great shape going into the election. But this is his political style if we think of President Trump as having one.
Give us one example. We only have a few seconds of another president who might do that same thing.
Oh, Richard Nixon. We keep coming back to him. And when he was being investigated, when he was being charged with impeachment, he tried to make the story about a partisan Democratic Congress. In the end, it didn't work, but that was what he tried to do.
Also talked about student protesters to deflect from what he was doing.
Exactly.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, taking a look at this moment, which will be in history. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Remember when Demi Moore was founding member of the Brat Pack? She and then-boyfriend Emilio Estevez pole vaulted off of 1985 St. Elmo's Fire. Then there was Ghost. Oh, Demi throwing a pot on a wheel, her lover Patrick Swayze guiding her. Come on. A buffed Demi Moore in G.I. Jane, stonewalling an interrogator.
What is your father's name?
Dad.
How about brothers or sisters? You got any of them?
Dick, Jane, and Spot.
And of course, there's Demi, the favorite of the tabloids, married to Bruce Willis, posing naked and pregnant on the cover of Vanity Fair, everywhere with the much younger Ashton Kutcher. But in her enthralling new memoir, Inside Out, we also find out about a completely inappropriate childhood with teenage parents, episodes with drug addiction, body shaming, and a warning, a rape, which we'll talk about. We may not get into the threesome that Ashton requested, or the time she found out her dad was not her dad, or how she had help him pry suicide pills from mom's mouth. There's only so much time. Demi Moore joins us now from NPR West in Culver City. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And you let us know right at the start that it almost doesn't end well. It's a very brave launch of a memoir. It involves a 911 call. But you pose the question, how did I get here, this moment that you describe? And then you lay out the answer by going back to the beginning, born to an 18-year-old beautiful mom, your dad, not much older, a charming gambler. His luck would run out. They'd move. This must have been frightening as a child.
You know, the thing you always have to keep the perspective of is you know what your baseline is. So you can step back and look at it and go, wow, that would be terrifying. But if it's what you know, it's all you know.
Mm. You then learn how to adapt in a new place. You're always trying to figure out who am I? Where do I fit in? And it sounds like the phrase that you hear a lot, you faked it till you made it. And even when it came to acting.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Then what are the chances you meet a 17-year-old Nastasha Kinski at a pool? She'd been brought over to the U.S. by Roman Polanski to star in Tess. And you say it was watching her. She's supporting her mother at this point. That's when you realized you wanted to be like her. What was it?
We had so much that was similar, but yet I felt this huge divide because I was watching someone who was so self-possessed. She had a comfort with her sexuality and her body in a way that was absolutely foreign to me. Mm. And it just, from where I was sitting, seemed to be more free and more, just more comfortable.
Yeah. Well, because you're feeling completely unsafe and not protected by parents and not at all sure of yourself. And so you take on this kind of like, well, I'm just going to, again, fake it till I make it. And that brings us up to you leave home at 16. Your mom had already been letting you drive without a license for quite a while. I mean, just crazy stuff. And
yes.
Yeah. Producer Joel Schumacher sees you. There's so much here that we have to kind of move through it. And put you in St. Elmo's fire. But also, at this point, and now I think you're about 21, with addictions. Schumacher tells you one beer and you're fired. You find out later he helped get you into rehab. You know, you were forced to choose a film or a drink. What a lucky break.
If I had needed to do it just for myself, I didn't value myself enough. But the fact that they stood by me still allowed me to step in to do the film was truly divine intervention that gave me something that meant more to me, which was to do the film, and allowed me to start to begin to find some value for myself.
How shocking was that for you at that age? I mean, again, your parents, just incorrigible, and you'd sworn you weren't going to be like them, and in so many ways you weren't. Hardest worker, you. And yet to find yourself with one of their flaws.
Shocking only, you know, for a limited moment, because my path had been just continue to move, going as fast as I could, forward, forward, forward. And certainly, you know, there wasn't any place to, like, I could be shocked, but who am I going to turn to deal with that?
Right. Again, we have to fast forward because there's so much. Now you're having success, and you're becoming something of a symbol, a sex symbol in some ways, but you pose naked and pregnant. You liberate pregnant women. This is Annie Leibovitz's famous picture in Vanity Fair. You play a pole dancer in striptease. I'm really getting ahead here. You give those workers dignity. You're having this impact on other women. And we never hear you say, you know, fans would say this to me. Were you completely unaware or unable to see or feel how people felt about you?
I think yes and no. Certainly with the Vanity Fair cover, I was able to really receive the acknowledgments for that. Mm-hmm. In other ways, you know, the films, no, because at that time I was being dissected and criticized so greatly that it was hard to really feel or see that it was making a difference.
Which brings us to your relationship with men, because as you're talking, you just couldn't receive this good will. You find out, it's stunning as a young child, that even though you and your dad had lazy eyes, he's not your dad. Later, there's a guy named Val. You name him. A friend of your mom. He forces himself on you. He rapes you. And insinuates later, your mom sold you to him. He asks, how does it feel to be whored by your mom?
Yeah, for $500.
How does this shape your relationship with men?
Up until maybe 15 years ago, maybe not even that long, I wasn't even able to identify it as rape. I just assumed it was my fault and one of those things that I did wrong. Mm. That moment, one, I became an orphan because there was no way that I could even entertain that question.
Your mom's role.
Yeah, and I think my way of dealing with it was just to forge ahead and know that I better create something for myself because I couldn't trust anything anywhere else. But as it relates to men, yeah, it would be impossible for it not to be a filter through which everything that occurred for me was affected.
Well, you say that question that you ask at the beginning, how do I get here? Which at the end is, you know, falling off the wagon, your children with Bruce Willis aren't speaking to you, and you're realizing, wait a second, one of the ways you got there is you chose men with the same qualities as your charming dad and turned yourself inside out, the title of your memoir, trying to please them. I just want to talk briefly about those other men. I mean, Bruce Willis sounds like he's a guy who wasn't ready for marriage. You have forged a friendship with him. You're raising your children together. Ashton Kutcher, he was 25 to your 40. But you write, you still felt like 15, hoping somebody would like you.
There can be real areas of emotional stunting that occur. I started having a family at 25, and so most of those early years were already focused on being extremely responsible. And in a way, when I met Ashton, I was in a place where things were so stable and grounded, so I could actually open up to the idea of something that you usually have at a younger point in your life.
You could play.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to play and explore it. And I, you know, really want to clarify that it wasn't about trying to be young. It has to do with something that was missed, because when I was in my early 20s, the level of survival that I was still living in was extremely high.
But then he disappoints you. I mean, there's no other way to put it.
The truth is, I disappointed myself. I certainly would have preferred it went in a different way, but somebody can't do anything to you that you don't or haven't already opened the door to having done to yourself.
You say you were addicted to him.
Oh, definitely.
Put him as a priority over your family, your sobriety.
Yeah.
So where are you now? Obviously, you did a lot of work. Your children very much back in your life.
What I do know now, and a lot of where I'm putting my focus, is in really recognizing the judgments that I hold against myself. And, you know, it's not easy learning to love oneself. And yet, if anything, everything I do is knowing that what I do impacts my children. And how I feel about myself dictates how they feel about themselves. So I have a huge motivating drive to really unearth anything that is a block or a limitation that I call a misunderstanding or a misidentification that's existed in my life, you know, that I'm unworthy.
Because as you did with your mom, they will pick that up as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
And in the same way, recognizing that I, at a certain point, distanced myself from my mother, and in that distancing, lost my compassion for her. And when I lost that, how could I expect my children to hold compassion for me when I'm in a weak or low place, when I lost it for my own mother?
Demi Moore, her new memoir is Inside Out. Demi, thank you so much. Again, it's a gripping read. Thank you.
Thank you.
No matter where or when your day begins, start it with Morning Edition from NPR News. On demand, weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
The United Auto Workers strike at General Motors is in its ninth day today, the longest national walkout at GM since 1970. 30 GM plants in the U.S. are quiet. 46,000 full-time workers are out on strike. An additional 3,200 employees furloughed. To what end? Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
And remind us, what do they want?
Well, so a lot of this has to do with part-time workers, new workers, the idea that there are not guarantees that are typically associated with union work extended to a lot of new workers. And like everybody else, even the auto industry is moving towards shorter-term contracts with people, part-time work. You know, a lot of it is changing, and they want that flexibility. So the automakers say, we need the flexibility of a flexible workforce. And the union is saying, you know what, every time you guys see flexible workforce, that ends up in less job security not increased wages for us.
And this really came up after the crash of the auto industry in which, you know, the union gave up a lot and had this two-tiered pay system. And now they're saying, wait a second, you made billions in, you know, the last couple of years. But to the company side, in November, just 10 months ago, GM announced they were cutting 14,000 jobs, closing five plants in Ohio, Michigan, Maryland, because they said people weren't buying small cars because gas is cheap. So remind us how that factors into this strike.
Well, it's true, right? There is, and this happens, and we don't know that gas will always be cheap, but gas has been cheap for a few years, and it does actually affect the sale of a lot of these smaller cars. Even with larger vehicles, these automakers have figured out a way to make more efficient, bigger vehicles. The bigger the vehicle, the larger the cost of the vehicle, the greater the profit for the car maker. So they want to get out of the business of pushing small cars all around the world. That does affect profitability. It also affects where you make your cars, right? If you are making different cars, you don't want them necessarily made in one of your highest cost places, which is the northern United States or the unionized United States. So the problem is that amidst all of this, these car makers are making lots of money. And the United Auto Workers and unions in general are sore about the things they gave up to keep these companies afloat during the recession. And they feel that they've never been repaid for that. That work has never been realized. So that's where the tension is. Yes, they want to reinvent themselves. General Motors does. But at some point, the workers say, how come we're not getting a piece of the action?
Yeah. And they also want to keep one of those plants on that November list, the one in Detroit.
The Hamtramck plant, which is one of the biggest that they've got.
So where does this all go? Because first of all, we remember the car crash previously, the industry crash, was because the industry could not see. They had blinders on, couldn't see people were buying small cars.
Yes.
Now they're not buying small cars, so they're making the big cars. So they're also now making a bet on electric cars.
Right.
But also, this has become a political issue. We're seeing Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden joining the picket lines in Detroit and Kansas City. Bernie Sanders expected to in Detroit tomorrow.
Yep.
Will this strike bring UAW members, about a third of them voted for Trump in 2016, back into the Democratic fold?
Yeah. Remember that the front runners in the Democratic race right now, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, have very strong union credentials. These are people who have shown their support. A lot of unions have actually come out in support of Joe Biden earlier than they otherwise would have, at least not even waiting for a Democratic candidate to be named. So, yes, I think that you're going to not see a repeat of 2016. These union members are probably a little more solidly in the Democratic camp this time around.
We will see. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
It's Here and Now.
Uber says it won't reclassify its drivers as employees in light of a new law in California that limits the types of workers that can be deemed independent contractors. AB 5 was signed into law earlier this month, and it codifies a state Supreme Court ruling known as Dynamex that makes it harder for companies like Uber to call its drivers independent contractors instead of full-time employees with benefits. Joining us now for more is Monique Nobenici, who's chair of the Los Angeles and Silicon Valley Labor Employment Practices for the law firm Winston & Strawn LLP. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you represent businesses that are affected by this. What are companies thinking about this decision?
Well, I think it's an interesting and definitely a very important area of the law now that is being addressed. And it's really causing companies to look at their workforce, figure out whether or not their independent contractors are properly classified. The new law doesn't really change much as to what has already been in effect in California for the past year. As you know, Dynamex went into play in April of last year, and so companies have already understood the ABC test, and they recognize what they need to do. But the new law expands Dynamex and brings it into play for other areas like unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, Social Security, and so forth.
Well, and Uber says that previous rulings have found that drivers' work is outside the usual course of Uber's business, which is serving as a technology platform for several different types of digital marketplaces. How can Uber argue, though, with a straight face that drivers are not central to its business?
Well, I think Uber's position on this is that what they offer is a platform for drivers to connect with riders. And so they're in the line of a technology business, a software platform business.
Because there are a lot of people who would listen to that and say, well, wait a minute. Uber is a ride-sharing company. The drivers are obviously their employees.
I recognize that. And I'm sure that those companies recognize that as well. But the premise of those companies is not to provide rides. They're not another cab company. What they are is they are a technology company that connects individuals. Similarly, you have companies like Postmates. They don't offer rides. They're not in the business of delivering food. They're in the business of connecting drivers to a service that consumers want.
What do you think is at stake here for gig economy companies, not just Uber, but Lyft and other companies that rely on employees that might not actually be their employees technically, but they do work that is central to the company's business?
I think that every company who has independent contractors, not just those in the gig economy, are really going to have to look at their workforce and figure out whether or not they need to reclassify their workers. For some companies that will decide to make the switch to migrate everyone from an independent contractor to an employee, they're really going to have to look at their cost, and they're really going to have to look at the nature of their business. Consumers as well are going to have to think about that, because we're right now very much accustomed to, at the push of a button, having a driver outside of the building that we're at mm-hmm. and ready to take us in a minute. If, for example, you have a company that needs to convert a number of its workers into employees, we're probably going to have fewer of those employees waiting for us to push that button and use their services.
Could you envision a situation where somebody who drives, let's say, 40 hours plus per week for one of these companies is considered an employee, but somebody that drives 10 hours a week is considered an independent contractor?
Well, I think the position that companies like Uber and Lyft have taken is that it doesn't matter how many hours a week somebody is driving. They don't fit into factor B, which is that they're performing work that's outside of the entity's usual business, and therefore they're not employees of the company. So whether somebody works 10 hours or 50 hours, it doesn't make a difference for purposes of determining whether they're properly classified.
If this law does go into effect in California, do you think it's going to have an effect across the country? Are other states looking at this decision and determining what they'll do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that other states are certainly looking to California to see how this is all going to play out. And I think that we'll see a similar wave of legislation across the country following suit.
You know, I'm sure that you've had this experience too, but I know that when I talk to people about this, you get some people who would say, well, look, we've gotten so used to this business model, you couldn't possibly change it at this point because consumers are not going to go back to a situation in the case of ride sharing where they have to call a taxi and wait 30 minutes and maybe it comes and maybe it doesn't. They want what they're getting for the price that they're getting it right now. There are other people who look at this and say, well, we knew that this business model was not sustainable and was going to collapse at some point.
Well, I think that the law is the law, and companies are going to adapt to what the law is. And consumers are going to have to feel the effect of those changes. And that's either going to result in higher prices to the consumers or longer wait times for services. But I don't think that this is going to create a situation where employers are just going to, you know, skirt what the law is.
That is Monique Nobonici, who is the chair of Los Angeles and Silicon Valley labor and employment practices for the law firm Winston & Strawn LLP, which is representing businesses that are affected by this new law in California. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As anyone can tell you who has ever spent a week or several curled in a sniveling fetal position, there is no cure for the common cold. But scientists at Stanford and the University of California, San Francisco, may be on track to developing one. A study published in the journal Nature Microbiology this month describes a protein that rhinoviruses, like those that cause colds, use to replicate themselves inside human cells. And the scientists showed that by knocking out that protein, they could stop the virus in its tracks. Jonathan Diep was the lead author on the study. He joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for doing this. I get colds a lot. And so it sounds like, yay, we're going to knock out the protein and this will be over. But there's work to be done. Let's back up and explain. These viruses use a combination of their own proteins and proteins found in the host cell, if I've got this right, to replicate.
Yes.
You were able to stop that process in some human cells and in living mice. So how'd you do that?
Yes. So we identified this protein that was important for these viruses to essentially survive when they infect our cells. The way we did that was we use a new genome engineering technique called CRISPR-Cas9 to genetically delete that protein from human cells and mice so that they no longer produce that protein. And what we found was those cells and mice were completely resistant to infection. Mm-hmm. So essentially, get rid of the protein, get rid of the virus.
Well, did I hear CRISPR being used in there?
That is correct.
Well, and, you know, some people worry about this, you know, tampering with nature. Is there a downside to disabling this protein?
Yes, that's a very good point. We still do not fully understand what this protein does for our cells. What we showed was when we delete this protein, we're resistant to virus infection. We still do not have a mechanistic understanding of what are the other consequences of deleting this protein? And that's something that we need to figure out still and understand.
Well, so as you're doing that, why is this so hard? We have a vaccine for the flu, also caused by viruses. Why is the common cold so hard to cure?
Yeah, so a major hurdle has been there are more than 160 different kinds of this virus that we know of. And it's this huge diversity that has been a major barrier to really finding that elusive magic bullet that will target all of the viruses. So the strategies that we took was, what about the other side of the equation? What about the human cells or the host cells that the virus infects? And what is it that it needs from those cells in order to survive?
Yeah. What are the questions to you? I mean, what a fascinating thing to take up a study of the thing that might be so small in the world of health issues, but can be so big. You know, it affects so many people. What else fascinates you about the cold?
Yeah, and what fascinates me about viruses in general, I think these viruses are so efficient at doing what they do. Their entire genome basically is very small, and they only need that in order to cause such devastating diseases, not only for the common cold, but you look at other viruses that have plagued human beings. And they're so small with such small genomes, yet they can cause such big diseases. And it's that efficiency in nature, which really just fascinates me. It's just why I got interested in studying how did they do their damage and what are ways that we can prevent that to find a cure for humans.
Dr. Jonathan Diep, lead author on a study published this month in the journal Nature Microbiology, will link you, finding clues to curing the common cold. Dr. Diep, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
The New York City Council is about to do something strange for a progressive city like New York. The openly gay speaker, Corey Johnson, is backing a repeal of a ban on gay conversion therapy in the city. Gay conversion therapy has been discredited by the American Psychiatric Association, among other organizations. It's the practice of trying to change a person's sexual orientation from gay to straight. And while it is legal in more than 30 states, it has been illegal in New York City for almost 2 years. Corey Johnson joins us now from New York. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So, Speaker Johnson, when people ask why you're doing this, it's because you're afraid that your ban is going to get overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Explain.
Yeah, you know, this was a really hard and painful decision, but I am actually proud of the course that we're taking because we're standing with the advocates and the folks that have been working on this for a very, very long time. And as you just mentioned, one of the primary factors is our federal courts have become more conservative, not just the Supreme Court, as we know, but also the circuit courts in New York State and New York City is covered by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which has grown more conservative. New York City is being sued by an aggressive right-wing organization called Alliance for Defending Freedom. The Southern Poverty Law Center has deemed them a hate group, and their goal is to keep conversion therapy legal. They won't stop at any cost. There was a Supreme Court decision after we passed this bill in 2017 called NIFLA versus Becerra, and it showed that the Supreme Court is likely to apply a stricter level of scrutiny to restrictions on professional speech than it had in the past, which is what conversion therapy could be potentially categorized under. And the other main factor here is that earlier this year, New York State passed a statewide bill banning conversion therapy. They actually were able to go a little farther than us because they can regulate medical licenses. The state could. New York City couldn't. So advocates are happy with this action we're taking. Matthew Shurka, who leads an organization called Born Perfect, he's a survivor of conversion therapy, testified in favor of the repeal. I support it. And I couldn't in good conscience risk a bad decision that could have a chilling nationwide effect and potentially put more children in harm's way.
So you're not worried that if you repeal the ban in New York City, that all of a sudden therapists in New York City will start engaging in conversion therapy again?
No, only because we have now a statewide bill. Mm-hmm. The governor signed it into law a few months ago. The New York State Assembly and State Senate passed it. It protects minors, just like other states around the country have done. So we were able to take this action in New York City because the state which supersedes us actually took action on this earlier this year as one of the first bills they passed when the legislature convened in January.
Is it possible that you're not giving the Supreme Court enough credit and that, in fact, maybe they will side with you on this, and just as they did on the same-sex marriage case?
You know, I'm not, of course, a constitutional law expert. I'm not a lawyer, but the advocates like the National Center for Lesbian Rights and Lambda Legal, two of the major LGBT civil rights organizations in the country that work in the courts and on litigation, they're the ones that recommended we go down this path. So the folks that have the expertise, they came to us and said, we think this is the most responsible, prudent course of action, mm-hmm. and we hope you'll take it under advisement. I was conflicted because I didn't want to in any way buckle or give in to these right-wing organizations that are looking to weaken protections for LGBT people. But at the end of the day, I think this is the best course of action.
Do you think that another state or city ban will end up before the Supreme Court anyway?
Well, this bill that the state legislature passed earlier this year was passed after that Supreme Court decision I mentioned, NIFLA versus Becerra. And they believe that the way that bill was drafted for New York State, it would withstand legal scrutiny. So I can't speak to all of the laws and ordinances that have been passed around the country, but I believe this is the only one where they thought there was significant legal exposure. But this organization, Alliance for Defending Freedom, they're looking to challenge these type of laws across the country, not just on conversion therapy, but protections for LGBT people and also protections for reproductive choice. This is their modus operandi, and we don't want to give them any chance of succeeding in a way that could have a chilling effect nationwide.
Have you ever done anything like this before? Repeal a bill that you like because you don't want it to end up before the courts?
No, this is very rare. And as you mentioned, I'm openly gay. I'm openly HIV positive. I got my start in organizing and eventually running for office through LGBT activism. I've been out since I was 16 years old. I'm lucky that I had a supportive, loving, affirming family. And so for me, this is personal. And also as a legislator and leader of a municipal legislature, it's very rare that we would take a step like this. And I hope we don't have to take a step like this again, but we thought this just was the best course.
That's Corey Johnson, the Speaker of the New York City Council. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And we'd love your thoughts on this at hereandnow.org. Robin, it's interesting. He wants a ban on gay conversion therapy, right. but he actually is behind the effort to repeal it just so that it doesn't make it to right. what is now a 5-4 conservative appointed Supreme
Court. It's fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard of this, so it'll be interesting to see.
Well, and he said he's never done anything like this before.
Right.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.